my name is Farah Osbeck. Welcome to Military Law Matters, the podcast that gives you insight into military law so you know your rights and you don't become a victim of injustice. Today, we'll be talking to Brian Schenck. Brian's a lawyer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, who specializes in military law. Brian will talk about the avenues that military members and veterans have if their application has been denied at the Board for the Correction of Military Records, or the BCMR. So if your case was denied at this administrative level, you still have a chance to take your case to court and win. You could take the case to the Court of Federal Claims or the Federal District Court. You'll want to listen to this episode to know your rights as it pertains to your if your case actually had merit but was wrongly denied at the BCMR, either because they made a mistake or because you as the client were not able to articulate the issues in your case. Hello, Brian. So glad you could join us today on the Military Law Matters podcast, the podcast that serves the best listeners in the world, members and former members of the United States Armed Forces. How are you doing, Brian?
Great, Farah. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you, Brian. Thanks for taking the time to be on our podcast. So, Brian, it is our job to arm our listeners with knowledge so they don't become a victim of injustice. And I know that you are ready to arm our listeners with important information today. Brian Schenck is the owner of Midwest Military and Veterans Law in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's devoted more than a decade of his life to helping military members and former military members of all branches reach their legal goals. He's worked on numerous cases in nearly every practice area at every level. Brian has particular expertise in discharge upgrades and matters before boards for correction of military records. Brian's expertise in the very niche field of judicial review of military decisions gives his clients a unique advantage. And today, Brian's going to be talking about the avenues you have in federal court if your case is denied by the Board for the Correction of Military Records, or BCMR. In other words, you have more options if the BCMR denies your application. So that's what Brian will be talking about to us about today. So before I begin asking some questions, Brian, is there anything I've left out about your bio, your practice that you'd like to add?
No, I think that pretty much sums it up.
Okay, great, Brian. So, Brian, I know that you have a lot of experience with filing claims in federal court for your clients when the client's case has been denied by the BCMR. So why don't you first give our listeners an overview of what the BCMR for each service can do for veterans on active duty?
Sure. Well, like you said, the BCMRs are an acronym for the Boards for Correction of Military Records. And just as a matter of history, back in post-World War II, 1946, before 1946, disputes about your records or injustices in your military records were handled via private bills in Congress. So it was a huge burden, as you can imagine, after the war. Many, many people coming home having various issues in their military records needing to be cleared up, and those would each be brought to Congress via private bills. So this was essentially a mechanism to relieve Congress of that burden and create these civilian boards, which are considered the highest level of administrative review for each service branch. So, the Navy has one, the Air Force has one, the Public Health Service has one, Army, Coast Guard, and so on. So every branch has one of these boards. And for the most part, nearly every error or injustice in your records likely percolates up to these boards. So, I think the Air Force is the one that explicitly considers itself the Supreme Court, quote unquote, of administrative matters for that service branch. So they're highly, very, very important, and they have, quite a lot of power to correct injustices in your record, a really broad power. It's hard to sort of describe what cases might find their way up to the boards, but, almost every issue you might have in the military can be heard by one of these boards. So they're important.
Okay. And we probably might be able to discuss the type of cases when you first tell us about. So can you tell us, if the BCMR does deny a member's appeal, what are their options, a veteran or active duty member as well, what are their options in terms of going to court to seek relief?
Well, before I get into the judicial review or court part of this, it's useful to know that each one of these boards has a reconsideration process. And so if they're for example, if you have new evidence that wasn't previously brought before one of these boards, there may be an avenue for you to request a reconsideration by the board itself before you choose to go into court for judicial review. So the rules for reconsideration are highly specific and they're different for each BCMR. But typically the standard is new evidence, new relevant evidence that wasn't previously in the record or couldn't have been procured through due diligence. So it's important to know that that sometimes is an option, but failing that, you basically have two avenues for judicial review. The first is to go to a district court, either in Washington, D.C., or in the state or district of your residence, or to go to what's called the federal, the United States Court of Federal Claims, which is located in D.C.
Okay. So how do you know which one to go to? What are the differences between the two courts?
Well, the differences are jurisdictional, and it gets a little confusing because theoretically, if you have a BCMR decision, depending on the facts of the case and what relief is sort of in play, you could theoretically bring your case in the U.S. District Court or the Court of Claims. Now, practitioners prefer to go to the United States Court of Federal Claims because if you read these decisions and sort of track how the district courts and the Court of Federal Claims have kind of come down on various issues, you've got a better chance in the U.S. Court of Federal Claims. But it's a highly specialized court, and in order to get into the Court of Federal Claims, you need to have a money claim, meaning that the government must be on the hook essentially for a money payment. Which is distinct from the United States District Court, where you're really just seeking review of the BCMR's decision and not asking the court to award money, which is a big hang-up. I know this is a little bit confusing, but it's highly fact-specific, and it's without knowing, sort of speaking hypothetically about these courts, it's kind of hard to say which is the most appropriate, but. If you have a money claim, the Court of Federal Claims is likely your best option. If money isn't involved and you're trying to, for example, get a relook of your promotion or what have you, then the U.S. District Court is probably your best bet.
Okay. Let me ask you this. So when you were talking about just the money claim part of it, so what if there was an issue of someone was wrongfully not promoted and then they would be entitled to back pay? Would that include a money type claim, or would that be something where you would have to go to Court of Federal Claims? Because you will then, as a result of if you win the case, you would get the back pay. So how does that work?
Well, promotions are a particularly difficult area. Unless you have a really clear-cut entitlement to being promoted, the Court of Federal Claims probably won't hear it because there's a process that involves the service secretaries to promote someone. So, they don't wade into those procedures as a court. So if we just pare down the hypothetical and say, hey, say it's really about back pay or you were involuntarily separated before the end of your contract. And maybe it doesn't involve a promotion, but just the fact that you weren't allowed to serve out the remaining 2 years or so of your contract. That is a money claim because there is what they call a money mandating statute that would entitle you to compensation for those 2 years of active duty pay you were deprived of. That's a common claim in the Court of Federal Claims. Where you were deprived of back pay, and therefore that's what you're asking for is compensation for the back pay you lost. And that would be considered a money claim under what they call the Military Pay Act.
Okay. So I really, for our listeners, what I'm thinking is if you have any issue where your BCMR claim was denied and your reconsideration was denied, you probably want to talk to an expert, someone who deals with these type of cases, and someone like Brian who can then direct you and help you and figure out which court you need to go to, because as he said, it's very fact specific, and you as you know, the potential client don't really need to figure this out. You can work with your attorney to help you navigate, you know, the system. So rather than trying to, so thank you so much for that explanation. That's, I've learned something new myself. So Brian, you know, to give our listeners an idea of what type of cases these courts review, let's just come up with a simple scenario I'd like to pose to you. So let's say we have a veteran who was involuntarily discharged from the Army. This veteran then goes to the DRB. He was involuntary discharged with, let's say, you know, under the honorable conditions discharge. He goes to the DRB. His upgrade application is denied. He then goes to the BCMR, and the BCMR, and his application at the BCMR is that he has PTSD, which he did not know at the time of separation. We know a lot of veterans sometimes have PTSD-related symptoms, really don't want to get help, don't know what it is until they're now out and having a lot of problems keeping a job. He goes to a doctor. The doctor says you have PTSD tied to a deployment that the veteran was on. But the BCMR, let's say they deny his application. Now, what then can this person do? Let's say the BCMR says, well, we didn't find a nexus between your misconduct and the PTSD, and his reconsideration is denied. So how can someone like you help this veteran?
Well, there are a couple issues in that scenario, but if the ultimate goal in that fact pattern is for that service member to get medically retired, meaning that that person is arguing they should have been put through the disability evaluation system, and that there's a viable claim there. Of course, the misconduct plays throws a bit of a curveball into this situation, because you can be separated if you commit misconduct. There's no legal basis to be a process through the disability evaluation system. So we'll put that aside and say, just generally speaking, if you think you should have been retired medically, and you know, and prior to that should have been processed through the disability evaluation system, in other words, put before a medical evaluation board, a physical evaluation board, and then theoretically retired on the disability retired list, then that's a certain type of case that is often litigated in the Court of Federal Claims. And because the disability pay statute is a money mandating statute. So theoretically, there is subject matter jurisdiction in the Court of Federal Claims over that kind of case. Of course, like I've said, the misconduct plays a tough barrier. But, you know, taking a step back and saying, if your claim in your issue is I should have been medically retired, and that's a viable claim, then subject matter jurisdiction likely lies in the Court of Federal Claims. The second thing that you'd probably want to know about that is, you know, and a lot of cases in the Court of Federal Claims are dismissed because they're untimely. Typically, you have 6 years from the date of the error or whatever gives rise to the claim. That date, for you have 6 years from that date to go to the Court of Federal Claims. And in disability cases, like the one similar to the one you just proposed, the Court of Federal Claims employs what they call the first competent board rule. So if you were denied a medical evaluation board and never allowed to be processed through the disability evaluation system, the BCMR thus becomes the first competent board to hear your disability claim. And the date of accrual, the date of your statute of limitations, your six-year statute of limitations begins to run on the date of the BCMR's decision, because it is, quote-unquote, the first competent board to hear the matter. So I know that's a little confusing, but and many practitioners are confused by it. There are many, many cases get dismissed from the Court of Federal Claims because of timeliness issues or waiver issues.
Yeah, and Brian, I know. So it's something that, you know, the listeners out there, and if they have, you know, claims or applications they want to submit to the BCMR or DRB, they really need to be aware that there are statute of limitations, time limits for all of these. So it's best to as soon as you are aware that there is something you want addressed or corrected, you need to talk to, you know, at least find out, file an application or talk to an attorney who can go over all of these different processes and the time limits, because it would really be a shame if someone has a real claim and they're barred based on the statute of limitations. Yeah, I'm glad you did talk about the statute. I meant to ask you that. So just to backtrack just a little bit, as far as, you know, that's not maybe the crux of this issue, but can you just give an example? Because I know you've done a lot of cases at the BCMR and probably had clients with the PTSD issues or other issues, but can you give an example of maybe a case where there was misconduct, but based on the PTSD, there is a nexus where someone can be awarded a retirement? What type of factors do the services look at to say, yes, you did commit misconduct, but, you know, there's a nexus and we're going to, you know, award you a medical retirement or medical separation?
Well, those, it's very difficult. And frankly, in full disclosure, I don't think I've ever had a case where we were successfully argued that they should have been processed through the physical evaluation system, because the rule stands that if you commit misconduct, your misconduct separation does not take precedent over whatever medical disability you might have. And the boards are loath to direct retroactive disability evaluation processing or medical retirement when somebody has a proven misconduct. I mean, you know, I guess theoretically, you know, a good case would be that you totally disprove the misconduct portion of it, and basically say the separation was unlawful. And then, you know, if you are successfully arguing that, if you do that successfully, then you say, hey, look, the separation was unlawful here, and I should have been processed through the disability evaluation system. That's probably the best way to do it. I mean,
okay.
PTSD and the nexus you're talking about, that's a common issue for discharge upgrades, where you're seeking to have your OTH, other than honorable discharge, upgraded to a general, but you're not asking for a medical retirement, just that upgrade. And PTSD, therefore, can be a mitigating element of the misconduct. So you sort of concede there was misconduct, but you use the PTSD diagnosis to mitigate its severity and ask for an equitable upgrade.
Okay. Okay. Have you seen cases that where clients were successful with that argument, where the board did find a nexus between the PTSD and the misconduct?
Yeah, it's super common. In fact, there's new guidance from the DOD as of, I think, 2014 and maybe the year before, which puts these sort of PTSD misconduct discharge upgrade cases in a very specific category. I believe this the change from DOD was brought on by a successful lawsuit against the discharge review boards. And now, essentially, what they've done is reduced or liberalized the evidentiary standard to prove someone has PTSD, and they've given better, more sympathetic consideration to how PTSD might have influenced misconduct. Common misconduct being drug use that might be self-medicating, going AWOL due to mental health issues, or even committing a violent act. And yes, these discharge review boards and BCMRs have upgraded discharges that involve PTSD as a mitigating factor. So,
okay, yeah,
it's a common case and often a successful one. I mean, maybe often is a bit extreme, but they can be successful if you've got PTSD, and it can act as sort of a mitigating factor.
Yeah, Brian, I think so. What you were referring to, the guidance, I've seen that as well in 2014 with, I think, Secretary Hagel during his tenure. They put out a memo basically encouraging people to come forward if, in fact, you know, they may have PTSD that was not addressed. And I think they were actually focusing on Vietnam errors when PTSD was probably not even recognized at that time. And a lot of veterans from that era, you know, had issues. They were discharged and having problems. So they wanted, of course, the VA and DOD wants these veterans to get help. So, but it applies to veterans from today too, the individuals who were
right.
discharged or deployed to Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. So it's really, it's very important. Thank you for bringing that out because it's important for people to know. And I just find, you know, in talking to clients, some people don't, you know, the tough kind of guys or gals who don't even want to acknowledge that they have a problem, don't go to see, get help. And then after they are out of the service, you know, they've been discharged and they're just having a hard time going on with life. They realize they do have PTSD and need help. So, you know, the DOD and VA definitely wants individuals like that to come forward if, in fact, they have evidence. I mean, they're not going to just upgrade people's discharge, but if there is some nexus between the misconduct, like you said, the type of offenses involved, and there's a balance, of course, they're not going to, depending how violent the crime is, et cetera. So thank you for highlighting that and explaining that. So in this-
Oh, just to give one extra, Farah, just yes. for your listener, there's just one extra nugget that's useful. You know, we were talking about this guidance to sort of liberalize the PTSD misconduct rules. And, you know, importantly, in 2014, the memo that Secretary Hagel issued says that even cases that were denied under the previous rules, meaning before they changed the PTSD misconduct rules, all those cases get what they call de novo review. So even if you had gone prior to 2014, arguing that your PTSD is mitigating factor with your discharge, and that was denied, you get a fresh look. It's as if you hadn't gone before at all. So there are many, many people who had gone prior to 2014 that had these cases that, according to Secretary Hagel, now get a fresh look. So their denial is put aside if they wanted to go back to the board and give it another shot.
Okay, and that's without no time limits involved, correct?
Right, they're waiving the time limits with the BCMR. Of course, the DRB, Discharge Review Board, has a statutory 15-year deadline that can't be waived. So if you're outside of that 15 years, you've got to go to the boards for correction of military records, which have a waivable statute of limitations, and those will be waived in every case, and you get a fresh look even if you've been denied before.
Okay. Yeah, the BCMR, it's three years, right? For every service, I believe it's 3 years for the BCMR.
Yes.
And I've heard before, I don't know, you know, if you have a good case, if the case is valid, they're not going to deny it based on the three-year limit, if in fact you have a valid cause. But if you don't have a case, then they may cite three-year statute of limitations. I don't know if that's what you've experience in the past as well.
You know, in my years of doing this, I've only seen one case, and it was a public health service case that got rejected as being out of time. I mean, these boards routinely waive the 3-year deadline upon a showing that it would be quote unquote in the interest of justice to do so. I've never seen a case where they didn't waive that 3-year deadline, you know, provided you make an affirmative showing that it's within the interest of justice, which is a pretty relaxed, liberal standard. And you know, I've never had a case where they didn't waive it.
Which is great. This is great to know for the listeners, because if you are past your 15 years and then you hear, oh, BCMR, you have 3 years, you know, okay, it's 3 years from when you should have known or known about the issue, but the 3 years is not going to be an issue. So if you have a case, basically you need to either file an application or consult with someone who can help you file the application with the BCMR. Don't worry about the 3 years at this point. So, Brian, can you give us some tips, give the military community, our listeners, some tips regarding what should someone do if they believe there's an error or injustice in their official records that they want corrected? What's the most critical thing they need to start thinking about? You know, they discover, oh, I've got this error, some injustice, and I need it corrected. What are some things that they need to immediately begin doing before even consulting with an attorney?
Well, I think your success at the BCMR or federal court really starts at the moment of the injustice. And, you know, I would say the first thing is not to be complacent. If you think you're in the middle of something that might turn out to be a career affecting error or injustice, you should really, you know, fight it at every turn and as early as possible, because, you know, many folks are, for example, if they're facing a separation, they get fed up and they just sort of roll over and let it happen. But in the meantime, they might be affecting the future BCMR or federal court case. So, you know, being, I don't want to say skeptical, but being aware, you know, that perhaps the military doesn't have your best interests in mind all the time, and fight things when you think it's, you know, being conferring a detriment to you, that starts right away. And, you know, contacting a lawyer when you're as early as possible is very important. Preserving evidence, create a paper trail, hold on to every scrap of every document that you can as you're moving through your matter. That's an important piece too. So, you know, exhausting every avenue, potential avenue for relief, putting up as much fight as you can if you really think you're being harmed, you know, is a big part of it, because, you know, you can theoretically waive your right to various avenues for relief if you don't fight them as the issue is sort of developing.
Okay. Great advice. And regarding records, I find a lot of clients, when you're asking them about, you know, what's in their records, I find they don't have the records. Where do members go to get their records if they don't have their discharge paperwork or their medical records? Where can they go to find those records?
Well, the first place is to go to, well, it depends on when they were discharged and from what branch, but there is a standard form called the Standard Form 180, SF-180, that you could Google and it'll come up, and you can get your service records and likely some medical records. Now, if it's a medical issue, you may need to submit a request to the VA. But I always start with that Standard Form 180, submit that. You'll get every centrally located record that's available. And then, you know, go from there. I mean, if you have an inspector general complaint that's relevant, that's a specific request under the Privacy Act or the Freedom of Information Act. It just sort of depends on what records you need and where you're going. But for your discharge papers and your official military file, submit an SF-180 to the appropriate location, and the form will have that location, depending on what branch of service and when you were separated. But, you know, an attorney would be very helpful in sort of navigating the records acquisition portion of a case, which is very, very important. And it's very important because the applicant bears the burden of producing the evidence to the BCMR. They will not investigate. So you are responsible for getting all the good evidence that you can get to support your case, because the board won't do it for you.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. And I know the BCMR, sometimes people get confused as far as clients think they can actually go and appear before the BCMR, but I believe that's very, very rare. It's mostly based on what you submit in writing and the documents. Is that your experience as well, Brian?
That is my experience. Amongst practitioners, it's an ongoing sort of point of dark humor that they offer this option of having an in-person hearing, but I've never heard of any being granted. I've never had a case where they granted a hearing, and, you know, it's a major point of contention, because many of these cases would benefit from some sort of in-person fact gathering hearing, where the person could go up and explain themselves, and a lawyer could maybe explain the legal argument they're trying to make. But, you know, for whatever reason, No, I have never heard of a hearing being granted in a BCMR case, and it's a real shame, and it's a real disservice to our members and applicants to these boards, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I know when I have clients, I love when they're within their 15 years, if they're trying to do an upgrade of their discharge or get something changed, because you are, at with every service, you're entitled to a personal appearance. And I always tell clients they should request that appearance, because it just makes a lot of difference when you can go in there, the board members can talk to you, ask you questions, and really, you know, figure out where the error, injustice, et cetera, occurred, or impropriety. So I always recommend clients to take advantage of that personal hearing, which is why I really like the DRB process, where you can actually go there, unless there's an obvious injustice where they can upgrade it without you even showing up, which they actually, when they review it, they can upgrade it. And if they see on the rec on its face, and you don't actually have to go to the hearing itself. So Brian, as a military member, so you're a attorney who helps clients with these types of issues. So what should a military member do who perhaps either is seeking some relief, either they're trying to get a medical retirement, they believe they were denied, or get reinstatement to the armed forces, and you know they failed, their applications were denied at the BCMR level. What can you then do for clients if they contact you?
Well, you know, just as a general matter, I've seen many, many cases be denied when they otherwise shouldn't, and then because they were brought by someone who didn't really know the rules, and therefore wasn't able to, you know, successfully navigate the process. You know, they call these pro se applications, for example. You know, having an attorney early on the case is very helpful, and I think a key to success in a lot of ways, because this is a very nuanced area, and cases can get complicated, and there are a number of pitfalls you'll want to avoid. That and a person who has experience with these boards, you know, would be very helpful in having you avoid. So, you know, what I do is you know, evaluate the case, utilize my experience with past cases to present the board with the best possible argument for success. I mean, you know, and then, you know, part of an effective application to the board is setting it up for possible judicial review. So knowing, having an attorney who knows what could happen if you're denied, is important, because setting this up for success in federal court is something that starts with the BCMR application, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know a lot of people try to do these applications on their own, and they certainly can. And if it's a clear-cut case, perhaps they can be successful. But I think the benefit of having an attorney who, and not every attorney does this type of law, someone who knows the ins and outs, the rules, and how it all works, it's beneficial. So it's kind of like penny wise, pound foolish, because if you have an attorney who has expertise in this area, they can navigate it and go through the strategy and file your case in the way that could get you the redress you're looking for. So now, Brian, I know you're physically located in Minnesota, but you help members all over the United States, correct? How does that work?
Well, it's a federal practice. I am located up here in the Great Tundra of Minnesota, but you know, because it's a federal practice, I can represent people from anywhere, and I do. I have lots of clients all over the world, and you know, it makes no difference where they're at. I can handle the case. A lot of this stuff is electronic, and so long as you have a phone and email, we can work together to build your case. So, you know, all of these applications tend to be filed in the DC area, and you rarely have to show up for a hearing if it's a BCMR. If it's DRB, you know, I fly out to DC to represent folks in their hearings. But by and large, it's really conducive to a sort of email, phone call, sort of arrangement. And yeah, I can do it with anybody from anywhere.
Yeah, anywhere in the world. And with Skype and all the technology, you could actually see the client, right, face-to-face on Skype. So I explain that too to members. You don't, you know, if you're in the area, you can, you know, go meet your attorney. But these type of cases, you can definitely, you know, help your client by talking to them on the phone, using Skype, whatever means. It's a matter of getting all the paperwork the attorney needs to help you. So, Brian, you are a wealth of knowledge. I've actually learned a lot today just by talking to you, and it's obviously you have a lot of expertise in this area and legal knowledge. So thank you so much for sharing all your wisdom, your legal expertise with our listeners today. And, you know, the takeaway, I think Brian is basically, you know, telling us there's, if your cases get denied, you know, go through all the levels, go DRB, BCMR, depending on the case. But there's also other avenues in court that you can get redress. Perhaps, as he said, perhaps you did your own BCMR appeal and it got denied because you didn't, you know, submit the required items. And now you have a chance with an attorney, actually, like Brian, who could help you file the paperwork and the applications in the Court of Federal Claims or the Federal District Court. So is there anything you'd like to add before we sign off, Brian?
Nope. I really appreciate the opportunity, Farah. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. Thanks so much for taking the time to arm our listeners with knowledge this afternoon. And I hope to have you back on our show. So for now, take care, Brian. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for listening today. If you want to learn more about military law topics so you're armed with knowledge, subscribe to my podcast. Head over to our website, militarylawmatters.com. And if you have a problem I can help you with or topics you'd like to learn about, send me an email at info@militarylawmatters.com. And if you know someone who this podcast may help, please share it with them. The takeaway today is if there's an error or injustice in your military career, there is a way to correct these errors or injustices through the Discharge Review Board process, Board for Correction of Military Records, or through filing a suit in federal court. Until next week, stay well and never ever give up, because there is always hope.